Every great company starts the same way, with a dream. Not a pitch deck, not a spreadsheet, but a vision. And behind every entrepreneur is the same starting point, a belief that something better is possible and the willingness to take on the risk of trying to build it. Welcome to Dreaming Big. I'm Alexis Allen, and I'm a relationship manager on the Texera Locker Group at UBS. I've spent the last decade working alongside founders across industries and stages. From ideas scribbled on napkins to companies scaling faster than anyone expected, I have seen what it really takes to turn vision into reality. What has always drawn me is not just the outcome. It is the optimism, the grit, and the ability to hold a vision long before anyone else believes in it. On Dreaming Big, I sit down with entrepreneurs to talk about where that dream started, the moments that shaped them, the pivots they did not plan, what they're building, who they're becoming, and the lives they're trying to live along the way. And so we go deep into identity, turning points, joy, and the seasons where that dream felt fragile but somehow survived. This isn't just a podcast about startups. It's about making something out of nothing, about protecting an idea long enough for it to become real, and about the courage to keep going day after day. And so whether you're building your first company, scaling your fifth, investing in a founder, or simply drawn to people who see the future before it exists, this is for you. This is Dreaming Big. And so let's dive in. Today, I'm thrilled to introduce you to someone whose journey is absolutely fascinating. Her name is Lizzie Liebne, and she is the founder and CEO of The Quiet Lux. She is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, Inc., and her views are her own. The Quiet Lux is a modern concierge service that is redefining what luxury actually means. But here's what makes Lizzie's story so compelling. She's a veteran, a Forbes 30 Under 30 honoree, a former venture capital investor, and someone who originally worked on Wall Street. She went from analyzing investments and sitting on the other side of the table to becoming a founder herself. And the Quiet Lux isn't just another concierge service. It's a wellness product that treats time as the ultimate luxury, helping ambitious professionals reclaim their lives from the invisible mental load that so many of us carry. And what I love about Lizzie's approach is that she refuses to apologize for wanting life to feel elegant and structured. She's obsessed with luxury brands and is applying those same principles of quality, attention to detail, and customer obsession to building a service that makes life feel less chaotic and more intentional. Welcome to Dreaming Big.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with your background, because your path is anything but conventional. You grew up in the States, you went to Northeastern, and then during your undergrad, you actually took a mid-degree military leave, from my understanding. Then you came back to the States, you finished your degree at Northeastern, landed a job on Wall Street. And so by the time that you started kind of your longer-term career, you had already had some incredible experience. So I would love to just hear about how, a little bit more about how those experiences kind of really did lay the foundation from what you built your career upon.
Yeah. I wish I had been that thoughtful, right? Like you said it and like, ooh, that person's really thoughtful and intentional. And I think for me, what has been true since well beyond I even knew how to define the parameters of what a career looks like is I'm very, very mission driven. I care a lot about who I am. I care a lot about the person I see looking back at me in the mirror. I care a lot about my family, my community. And I had long dreamt of joining the IDF. I had long dreamt of serving as a combat soldier, which you age out of. I found it to be the ultimate way to give back. And I think like any good deed, I took more than I gave and I had nothing else to give. But to me, it was so normal. And so it's even interesting to hear you use the word that like it's not conventional, because I don't even think I see convention in some ways, which for my resume, that doesn't reflect, like unless you get into it with me, you look at my resume and you see like, okay, check. Bank, check, venture capital, check, entrepreneur. But the devil really is in the details of like the decision making. Why did things at different times? I think the one truth that is always held to be true, whatever way you want to say that, is that nothing goes according to plan. So I always kind of have a range of what I want to do and what I want to accomplish. And I anticipate that things are just like not going to work out that way. But the goal is to still be within like a certain range of what I actually want to accomplish, which has always been true.
I really appreciate and value the reflection of the fact that you are so mission driven and how that's kind of been a through line, both from the formation of your career, but also kind of how that's trickled down through all the various roles that you've held. And I think that for so many, you know, great entrepreneurs, your point around being conventional versus non-conventional is exactly right, which is most of them do not kind of stay on a straight and narrow path. And I think that your story is certainly one of that. So tell me a little bit about
After Wall Street, you joined a couple of VC firms, and I would love to hear about how that experience was and, how that kind of shaped how you thought about entrepreneurship and what separated, the good from great founders.
Yeah, so I actually didn't know anything about entrepreneurship when I joined venture capital. And this actually, like, this certainly doesn't make me any friends. I moved to Israel and I thought I was going to join a hedge fund. And I was like, I'm a value investor by trade. Like, I was like, no, I'm not going to be in venture capital. But what did happen, and obviously, like, this is one of the, like, best pivots of my life, which was kind of by accident, was applied to this job, to this fund, that it was its first fund. And I got to work alongside four incredibly experienced partners in everything from fund formation to deal flow to portfolio management, and really exposure in a way where if you are in the straight and narrow, you don't really get that chance, because by the time you hit principal or hit partner, you've, like, been effectively de-risked at every level. And because it was like me and four partners, I got to do everything. And I think that was my first understanding of both what an entrepreneur is in the, like, venture capital sense, and also that I have drive and, like, my own accountability in ways that, like, it's not an external force. It's very internally driven, because I didn't have parameters to this role. And I think that, and only in hindsight, I guess I kind of knew it, but, like, people struggle when they don't have parameters. I love not having guidelines and parameters. And, like, that's where I get energy. That's where I'm like, oh, I got this. So that was my first experience there. And then Samsung Next was expanding their team, which was such a huge opportunity for me to be able to be like, okay, I kind of understand what's happening in Israel in the entrepreneur land. So that was really where it was the first time I had ever experienced what it's like to, like, find my mentors. And it, both the partners in my fund and also just the management at large, like, I really felt like I could, like, be coached by them, which is not a given in any venture capital firm. Any question I had, any way to do business, which, like, venture capital in many ways is a sales job. So figuring out, like, the nuance and like the flavor of, like, what sales means to you, all of that, like, rolls up into how I now see entrepreneurship. But I don't think definitionally I was ever the one who understood the straight and narrow type of entrepreneurs, but finding kind of the diamonds in the rough and unwiring what I'd been hardwired to do in a bank, which is, like, in a bank, there's a standard way to run a meeting. You go to VC and you are meeting thousands of people who are exceptionally brilliant, but they're brilliant in different ways. So I think I just learned that, like, being an entrepreneur is a lot of, like, what you assign to the word, and a lot of understanding that people are just people, and, like, having the flexibility to actually appreciate that, versus especially coming from a Morgan Stanley where everything is like, you can't use the wrong color blue in a deck, right? We both know that.
Yeah, I can really appreciate the fact that it probably was a pretty different shift in terms of how you operated. But I also love that you probably got a lot more autonomy in working in venture than you would have if you had kind of stayed, on Wall Street. And I also appreciate the fact that it sounds like you're pretty great with dealing with ambiguity. And I think that a lot of people would struggle without kind of those constraints and barriers and being given a set of tasks and knowing what to do first and how to sequence them. But for you, it seems like you know how to look at a lot of white space and be able to fill it with your own processes and being able to test out different things.
And I didn't entirely know that people preferred tasks, if that makes sense. And I think a lot of my own growth, especially managing my own team now, has been on the people side of things, where, like, actually understanding that some people just want tasks. They just want to be told what to do.
I think that's probably like a really nice segue into the fact that you may not have been able to identify it early on, but like those are very clear signals of what makes great entrepreneurs and great founders is the ability to, not just like tasks, but love the white space, love filling it up, love imagining it broader than the space that you're even given, and knowing that so much of developing a company and a team and fulfilling a vision is not a series of tasks. It is really an innovative process. So at this point, you're crushing it in VC, you're Forbes 30 under 30 honoree, and then you make the decision to become a founder yourself. Tell me a little bit about what that process was like, whether you had the idea first and then you wanted to go after it, or whether you kind of saw a lot of it that made great founders and then wanted to apply that to yourself.
I think it was something from, like, within me that was like, I just really want to do this. So I wish I could say that all the decision making was not. I serve in reserves. I was in reserves in 2023, 2024. And then when I got back from reserves, my fund actually pulled out of Israel. I felt super fortunate, which I know is a weird follow-on sentence, but the thing about doing any form of service or reserve duty or really doing any of these like larger than life experiences is it gives you so much perspective and understanding about what matters. And I had been in a place where I was like, I'll find a job. It's fine. But I think a lot of it was, I was like, okay, I've been forced into a decision point. Like, what do I actually want to do? And I think a lot of the advice I got at the time from senior venture capitalists and one very senior female venture capitalist was like, Lizzie, you and your husband have got to decide, like, how long are you going to go for this? What's your runway? What's your budget? Like, how long can you live without a salary? And that was on the like more practical side of things. And then on the career side of things, I really was like, you know what? I've always wanted to do something. This is my time. How do I make this happen? And so that's when I started where everyone else starts, which is like, what are my own problems? And in tandem, I got really good advice from David Lee, who runs Samsung Next. And what he told me and what lives with me is do not get stuck ID eating. Just go. And I told him about my idea and he was like, Lizzie, just go, like go. And so I just started going and I haven't stopped going since. But I don't think without that push, I would have made the same decision, which is to just go because it is so scary. And I think the mental exercise of just being willing to like, embarrass yourself and be cringe and put yourself out there and rejection, fear of failure, and like, really, I can go through it. Like it lives with me. And it's funny because other people would say I'm confident and I'm like, I don't know that's true. I don't feel particularly confident, but I'm not scared to do because of what other people think.
You know, I think that the ability to just go after something and again, jump into a process or an idea is such good advice. And it's so much easier given than taken because a lot of people want to find the perfect right solution. And it takes a really long time to do that. And what usually ends up happening is you pick a problem and you ideate from there. And it may take a ton of pivots to ultimately get to what the later stage of your company looks like. But it's really hard to get there without getting some signal from the market and doing some testing. And so I would love to hear about a little bit about the early days. So how did you come to the problem that you're solving now? And what did the early ideation and testing look like?
Yeah. So where I started and where I am are not the same place. It's conceptually the same, right? So where I started was we're going to be a milestone manager. I came from my own problems, came from what I saw my peer group going through, which is weddings, babies, designing an apartment, not in a super expensive way, problems that my peer group very much share at this age. What the market research said was, you know, I interviewed 150 people in the tri-state area, in my age group, friends, really anybody who would talk to me. And what I learned from that is that in many homes, there's a different budget for a milestone. And so what that market research allowed me to hone in on, which was actually what my problem was, which is daily life. How do you solve problems in daily life and what are those problems? And so from there, I said, okay, that is a big question. I don't really know how to answer that. What I'm going to do is as follows. I went onto LinkedIn and I pitched 20 different women. Of the women I reached out to, 20 responded to me, 10 joined. And I reached out to them and said, hey, have this idea. Would you be willing to pay me $20 for 3 months to participate in this pilot program? Call it my founding club. I call them my founding members. So it's fancier titled than pilots. But they were like, wait, so you're going to do this for me for $20 a month. And all I have to do is give you feedback. And I was like, yes. So what I was testing at that time was A, trust. Like, will people trust me? B, like, what are the parameters and like scope of where tech can actually solve this problem? Because a concierge business, the labor business, is a new concept, but it's a difficult concept. And C, what does the cost structure of this look like? So I think just to borrow from my previous life as a tech-enabled service investor, you know, you look at Hims and Hers, Roe, my former portfolio company, Lemonade Health, they really had to figure out what their labor looked like, not just what their tech stack is and where their tech innovation is. And so I did that for 3 months. In those 3 months, we did something like 1,200 requests. It was crazy. I was working nonstop. But at the end of 3 months, I had a data set of like, okay, this is what I'm doing. This is what I can do. This is what I can't do. And then I had the test of, will people actually pay me market for this? And what is market? So then I converted 8 out of my 10 to full paying customers, which the rate at that time was a $6,000 annual rate. And I've since increased my pricing to $7,500 annually. And from there, we've grown purely word of mouth. So there's a lot of questions I'm still working on. And I think the intellectual honesty of actually just building hypotheses, going to test them and seeing where you're wrong. And I'm wrong more often than I'm right, but I've been able to be right in a few like very key parts. And that I think has driven the growth within the a little over a year that we've been around.
It's such a great story about how initially your hypothesis was right. It just took a different form in terms of a solution, and it's evolved since then. And so I think that the sign of a great entrepreneur is one that recognizes where changes need to be made and where things can be better. But like any business, it should evolve over time. And so what I love about these types of conversations is it's not the look back to a successfully exited founder and, you know, tell me what went right and what went wrong. And it was very clear. And it's, you know, hindsight is 2020. You're in the middle. And I think that's what's exciting and interesting and fun. Obviously, you've seen a tremendous amount of change and growth in the past year. But when you think about even, you know, next year and the year ahead, you know, we've talked a little bit about growth, but what's getting you excited about what next year will look like? And from a growth perspective, kind of what are the metrics that you're looking to hit and evolve into?
Yeah, I think the danger of loving being an entrepreneur is once your dreams have been unlocked a little, you're like, oh, now I'm dreaming huge. Like I started a little bit timid. There's not a timid bone left in my body. So my vision is I want every single ambitious professional in New York City to wake up, look at their to-do list and say, I don't want to do this. I'm sending this to Quiet Lux. And how we get there, when we get there, I don't care. That is what I want to make happen. And I want to do that in such a large and massive way. And in order to do that, we're actually going out to raise our first round of funding to fuel that growth. We have been totally revenue-based, bootstrapped, whatever we want to call it to date. And I have such a clear vision. When I close my eyes, I can see what I have to do and what we have to do and what we have to accomplish. And I'm really excited about what the next year will bring in that regard, because the more I mean, it's a bit addictive is the truth. The more you do, the more you want to do, the more you uncover what's right, even at the expense of what's wrong. I don't even care about what's wrong. Like, how accurate do I have to be? You just have to be accurate in a few really key spots. And that is what I'm honing in on. So I'm really excited about next year. I'm really excited about growing. My focus is growing predominantly within New York City and Manhattan itself, you know, the home of ambition, the home of people with large dreams and figuring out how to make it happen and grit and hustle. So I'm really excited about it.
It's really exciting. When we first talked, I remember thinking about what an amazing solution this is for so many people that I know, and something that I would love to have in my life. So tell me a little bit so that listeners can learn a little bit more about what the experience looks like for a member. Let's say they sign up, and where do you see people going to the Quiet Lux for things that they're looking for and things that they need support with?
Yeah. So what I call us is a modern concierge for your personal life. We support across life admin, life projects, and lifestyle. So what that means is we are a text and email based platform. You text us and you email us, and then we take care of the rest. So we are actually onboarding quite a few members right now. And the typical onboarding process is there's a trial month. That trial month allows our members to figure out how Quiet Lux fits into their like toolkit of managing their day-to-day life and what those requests can look like, or anything from doctor's appointments, dentist appointment, orthodontist appointments, scheduling therapists, finding therapists in network, sourcing clothes, sourcing gifts, figuring out and researching price comparison on vacations, on hotels. A lot of what we do is really the research. And then we present the options to our member, and then the member makes the decision. A lot of what we do, our users and our members wish they had time for. So a lot of the language we use when it comes to the business and that I've studied and tested is my demographic is they're very, very successful. They know the cost of that. They know there are trade-offs in life, and they wish they could do more things than they could do, but they can't. And so what we try to do, and I phrase it as like we're elevating your day-to-day, because you want to pick your gifts for your five-year-old. We're not going to send you a generic gift list. We know so much about your five-year-old because we've worked with you for a year. We are going to find you very intentional gifts within the budget you outline. And it's being that thought partner. It's not just the execution element of it.
I mean, it's great because it just integrates into their normal lives in a way that is both seamless and additive, but it's extremely valuable and extremely additive. You talked a little bit about studying and understanding your customer base, as well as obviously drawing from your previous experience, but I did a little bit of reading, and you know, you've talked about your interest in luxury brands and how it's informed. Yes, how it's informed how you've developed the Quiet Luxe. And so tell me about, you know, some of the companies that you really admire and what about those companies has resonated with you and how has it helped shape your company?
Yeah, the psychology of luxury is unbelievable, that we have convinced people, we as a society, that you need to spend $3 a night anywhere. And also, what does it mean to spend $3,000 a night at a hotel? Like, there's all these like conceptual and psychological questions that I really get stuck in, not as a critic, but as an observer, because I find it to be so fascinating. So the companies that I love to study are Hermes, LVMH. I model everything we do after Hermes. I love the company. I love their intentionality. So everything about how they've decided 74% of our goods are going to be manufactured in France because it's an art to manufacture goods. And they train from a very young age, their artisans who then learn one craft, then another, they grow them in-house. I think their employee turnover is like phenomenally low, if I remember correctly, something in this like 4-5% range. And then you're keeping like all the IP you develop within humans, you're keeping in-house. And it is just so, so thoughtful and well done. And the aspirational element of it, where you can not even buy some of the products if you go into the store without a relationship, I also find to be just so interesting from a consumer lens, right? Of like, what did they have to do to get to where they are today to convince people that that is the bag or the moment or the whatever it is that everyone needs to be perceived in a certain way? Because they've done it. Like, they're Birkins. And hear me out. I'm a practical girl. I don't think Birkins are that practical, but I love the concept. But like, I need a shoulder in there, you know? But it's just, it's really just amazing. I'm obsessed with people who are obsessed with their craft. I think that's why I find so much inspiration in artists and athletes. I would call myself creative, even though it's creative within business, just because being so obsessed with every detail of your craft and not caring what's going on around with the world around you is, I think, what gets everyone where they want to go. But it's inherently what we are all not. And so I find myself constantly like pushing to grow that engine within me.
All of those companies really are masters of their craft, both in terms of the products and experiences that they create, but also with, you know, how they do anything is how they do everything. It's just, yeah. It's excellent kind of across the board. I would love to transition from a little bit about, you know, what you've built to, if you kind of look back across so many of your various experiences, I would love to just hear about some of your reflections and, you know, your biggest learnings so far. And then if you were to look forward, you know, where do you see the Quiet Luxe 5 years from now?
So reflection wise, I think there are two. And one is knowing who you are and who you want to be and keeping that very, very, very close to you. And the second is perspective is everything. And I think those lessons of exchanging perspective, having thought partners, thinking through things with people who think through things differently has allowed me to grow faster than I would have otherwise. But the big caveat is, I had to give them space to want to be honest with me. And I think that that's what I see a lot of my peers losing, and they don't create comfort, like a comfort level within, whether it's their mentors, their peers, whoever it is, to actually exchange business ideas. I think the perspective comes from being able to create a base level comfort with people where like not everyone likes me, and that's fine. But I would argue that most people feel comfortable sharing their ideas with me and understanding that I'm going to be receptive and I might disagree and they might think I'm being an idiot about something and it's fine, but like, let's have that conversation. So I feel very, very lucky for that. And then for the next 5 years, I know this company has a right to exist in the way that I envision it. And I want to keep investing in my customers the way I've been investing in them. I want to keep being the company they can turn to, even when they think we won't do it, just because then we're able to do this like hospitality surprise and delight of, well, actually, we were able to figure it out. I want to be their trusted partner and I want to be like worthy of all of their referrals as a company. And I think that we have grown via word of mouth to date. But I do recognize kind of that the goalpost used to be somewhere else, even though I moved it as I grew. And I want every person in New York City who cares about their career to be a partner of Quiet Luxe.
That's an ambitious but achievable goal. So I'll be keeping track of how that goes. But I really do believe it's going to happen because you're not only ambitious, but you certainly put the execution against your vision. So I want to end with some rapid fire questions. So super quick, instinctive answers, starting with best advice you've ever received.
Know who you want to be and have core values and stick to them.
Love that. What's the first thing you do every morning?
Check my phone. I like wish I had some routine about like not just checking my phone and getting stressed immediately and hopping right out of bed.
I love the honesty. And look, as a founder, you have to know what's going on. For you, what does living a rich life mean to you?
Spending time, quality time, like high quality time with people I love and building a community with people around me.
It's beautiful. What do you wish you knew about? What do you wish you knew before starting your own company?
How much I would love it. Would have done a long time ago.
That's an awesome answer. I love that. What are you dreaming about next?
Taking over Manhattan, just being that company where everyone is like wants to understand more about it, right? Because that's how it starts. So that is what 2026 is focused on.
Awesome. Lizzie, thank you so much for the conversation. I know that the two of us could talk for much longer about a number of different ideas, but for those who are listening and looking to continue to follow your journey, where can they find you in the Quiet Lux?
They could find us on our website, thequietlux.com. They could find us on Instagram at thequietlux, or they could go old school and email me, Lizzy, at thequietlux.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Lizzie.
Thank you so much.
That was Lizzie Livne, founder and CEO of The Quiet Lux. If you're an ambitious professional in the New York City area who's ready to reclaim your time and elevate your life, you should check out thequietlux.com or find them on Instagram at thequietlux. As always, if you love this episode, subscribe to Dreaming Big wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. Remember, your dream is valid, your vision matters, and the world needs what only you can build. So thanks again for going deep with me today. And remember, keep dreaming big dreams.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.